it's going to create history and be our first ever MotoGP winner here at the Chang International Circuit in Thailand.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 580 for Wednesday, the 10th of October 2018, and I'm joined on the line by Len Padilla, our Spanish correspondent all the way from Pamplona.
Hey Andrew, how's it going?
Hey good Len, how are you sir?
Doing pretty well.
So did you enjoy some of the racing over the weekend from that new track in Buriam, Thailand?
I did. You know, I wasn't really sure what to expect. You know, not brand new circuit. I think Superbikes have been there for 3 years or 4 years, something like that. But, you know, new to GPs. I have to say, I really like the flyaway races. I like getting up first thing in the morning, watching the racing, and then having the rest of the day for other stuff. So, yeah, it was all good.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's nice sort of waking up in the morning. You can always kind of sit there and have breakfast and watch the racing, enjoy it, get over and done with, and get on your day. So, but before we go on to cover the racing from Thailand, we'll have a few choice news items selected and culled from all the various racing publications. Only the very best for our listeners. And then we'll get on to the racing, the Moto3, Moto2, and MotoGP from the Buriam International Circuit in Thailand. We did have some great news. As one of our listeners, Scott Saunter, was kind enough to put his hand in his pocket and donate some pennies to keep this show on the road. Thank you very much, Scott. Greatly appreciated. And if you fancy helping out, you can always check us out on the motopodcast.com website. You'll see the ability to donate there on the left-hand side. And equally, too, you can come to us via Patreon. patreon.com/motopod. Anything you feel like throwing in the hat really, really helps. Thanks very much. So moving on to some news, that wasn't too much news actually. The only things I really sort of picked out for arguably MotoGP is obviously Scott Redding having confirmed his departure from the GP to the British Superbike paddock for next year. He seems to be on a 2-year deal, and also sketching a bit more detail, saying that it sounds like he is doing that with the eye to a move in World Superbike in 2021. It sounded like he had preferred to see if he could find something at World Superbike, but in his mind there weren't really any championship winning bikes or seats in the offing. So he's sort of in a holding pattern, I guess, for that 2 years, see what he can do in British Superbikes and then see what's available for World Superbikes in 2021.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting one. I saw just the other day when I first saw this news, somebody compared his the age of his debut now in BSB, let's call it a debut, and the debut of Shaky Byrne in BSB, and it was roughly at the same age. It's hard to believe that that Scott's that young. We've been watching him race for so many years. It's amazing that he's only 25 years old.
Yeah, I was reminded by Dave recently that he took a win at 15 years old at Donington, you know, in Moto3. So that just shows you how long he has been in the MotoGP paddock. 2 years to do well in BSB. I mean, there's definitely some circuits on the calendar that he's going to go well at. He's going to know, he's going to be familiar. BSB also includes some pretty tight technical tracks that you really need to learn your way around to get the most out of it. It's a competitive field. So I hope he's going to do well. I think there'll be a lot of other riders in that paddock itching to benchmark themselves to a fairly recent MotoGP rider.
I certainly hope he does well. We've seen some riders go, you know, back from World Championships to BSB recently. The one that is coming to mind now is Sylvain Guintoli, who didn't actually set the world on fire when he went there. You know, you kind of got the impression that it seemed like a good idea when he was thinking about it and planning it. And then he got to some of the sketchier circuits that I can imagine him thinking, oh my God, I'm too old for this. So I don't quite know what Scott's going to make of some of those circuits.
Yeah, I agree. I think Scott's going to go better. I think Scott has got the anger, the adrenaline up. He wants to race. He wants to be competitive. And I think he will give it a really, really good go. And I'm really hoping he does well, because I remember speaking to him briefly in the paddock at Misano, and you can just see the passion in his face, and, you know, the disappointment where, and probably with the Spargo as well, not having a bike that they can compete and they can ride well on this year with the Aprilia in MotoGP. So in Superbike news, we found out that Jordi Torres has been released by MV, so he can concentrate on his MotoGP ride for Avintia. He's replacing the injured Tito Rabat on the GP16 at Avintia. So he was there in Thailand, and like I say, MV have released him. And I'm not sure who has been confirmed for... No, hang on a minute. I think it's Max Schlieb, if I remember. Maximilian Schlieb, the Superstock rider who was riding for Aprilia, has now been confirmed, I think, to take Jordi Torres' place at MV now that the European Superstock Championship is all wrapped up and finished. Max Schlieb finished third, so it'll be interesting to see how he gets on riding the MV in Argentina this weekend.
Yeah, do we know who's signed at... at Avintia next year? I mean, I don't know anything about Tito Rabat. I know that he's still recovering.
Well, Abraham's moving to the Avintia team, so he's you know, bought himself a ride there on what will be a GP18. It sounds like Rabat is most likely, but still has not been confirmed. You do wonder, with Torres honestly going very, very well and putting in some pretty impressive results, I think, considering how new he is to that bike and that style of bike, he might even run Tito, might even run him for that seat next year. We'll have to see. I sort of rather laughingly bet Greg Haynes a Big Mac if Torres does get that seat for next year.
Ooh, does that mean that if you win, you lose?
Well, exactly. You paint that however you wish, although he could be a chicken fillet kind of guy. I'm not sure, but we'll see. We'll see. Staying with Superstock too, we also heard that the American PJ Jacobson has split with the Triple M Honda, not having the best results and the best of the time with that. So I think it sounds like from a PR standpoint, they painted it that both have equally amicably decided to go their ways. I think the Triple M felt that it was an equally top line bike compared to the Red Bull Hondas, but PJ just maybe not getting the results that either of them were hoping for. It sounds like they've gone with Florian Marino, the French rider who finished fifth in the European Superstock Championship. He'll be coming in to replace PJ at the Argentinian round this weekend.
Interesting. It's too bad from the perspective of American riders doing well on the world stage and, you know, providing a path for the rest of their compatriots. It's happened already a couple of times, a couple of false starts, you know, big expectations from riders coming over from the US. Hopefully that doesn't sour the teams in either Superbikes or any other paddocks on the American riders.
Yeah, agreed. You know, I'd like to see World Superbike have a world representation from the riders. It was nice to see a Chilean coming in, but I mean, really, if you look down a lot of the grid on Superbikes, they are Europeans, and you know, it is nice to be able to pull in Americans. It'd be nice to pull in some Japanese riders and try and expand, I think, the interest in the grid that way. Maybe have that help improve the publicity and, you know, the attention of the series. So, yeah, it's always a shame when we lose someone like PJ.
Well, maybe like we were talking about the other day, maybe if someday World Superbike and the other national series get a little closer together, it'll be easier for riders from those other series to come over. We'll see.
Yeah, and I think that would be the cool thing, get back to just having a couple of wild cards in there on similar machining, on tracks they know well, sort of mixing that up and going well, pulling in some of the local crowds to cheer, and hopefully through that they discover, Superbikes in and of itself. But right now we're going to talk about MotoGP. So as we said, they rocked up to the new circuit at the Chang International Circuit in Buriam, Thailand. This is the first race at the new, it's a 4.6 kilometer track. It was opened in 2014. Superbike, we know, have been there since 2015, but this is the first year of MotoGP. They were out there earlier in the year in February. I think MotoGP had a 3-day test there just to get some experience, get some setup information. There were some initial comparisons, I think, to the to Austria circuit in the fact that it's definitely some pretty slow corners onto long straights, favoring bikes like the Ducati with their hard acceleration, and then equally those long straights going into some fairly tight turns as well, so favoring other bikes on the braking. We know the Ducatis are fairly good and strong, stable on the braking, but it was Honda, in actual fact, that dominated the test, with Pedrosa, I believe, fastest overall.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like I said, I'm one of these people that looked at the track and said, wow, you know, another Red Bull ring. But I'm guessing, well, from what I heard, lots of people thought that. And Dovizioso doesn't think that that's the case. I don't know if you saw him in the press conference saying that. And I'll be honest, I don't know quite what he explained or what he thought the big differences were, because it sure looks like it to me.
I think he was talking about more like Sector 3 and Sector 4, where... Yeah, initially in the first part of the lap, you have just got straight, corner, straight, hairpin, straight. But then after that, they've introduced enough sort of flowing corners, I think. And that, in his mind, seemed to neutralize the advantage that the Ducati had with the acceleration and the braking. So overall, for the lap time, you know, he felt it was fairly even Stevens between the Ducati and the Hondas. As we saw in this round, surprisingly, it also seemed to favor the Yamahas.
Yeah, that was super surprising. I hadn't really kept up on the practice and the practices before the qualifying. And when I saw, you know, where the riders, you know, what their combined times were going into qualifying, and then how the Yamaha riders did during qualifying, I was blown away. I really didn't expect that from them.
Now we'll see if this later turns out to be something to do with the heat of the track. I mean, it's a hot place to have a Moto Grand Prix. I mean, you know, day temperatures, I think, were easily up into the 30s. The track temperature was sort of nudging mid-50s with high humidity. A lot of the riders were saying that this was a much harder weekend physically than even the Malaysia rounds, as they dealt with the heat and the humidity. And in fact, I think they said it was some 10 degrees hotter than they'd experienced during their time testing in February.
10 degrees hotter. Crazy.
Some pretty tough times. So, I mean, you know, this I think also sort of limited, as we'll talk about, you know, some of the effort during the race. But generally, it was great to see, you know, Thailand really taking this motorcycle racing to heart. I think they had attendance on sort of like 100,000, you know, numbers. Most of the stadiums around the track were pretty packed. Initially, it did look like, you know, you think, well, maybe they're not that many people, but you realize actually they've all packed themselves to the top of the stadiums, to the grandstands, because that's where the shade was. Not many people sitting down near the front where they just were getting cooked in the sun. But one of the great things was just people's enthusiasm. We didn't see any booing. I know there was some concern from the commentators when they saw that the Valentino Rossi fans were sat right next door to the Marquez fans, but they all seemed happy as Larry, waving their flags and having a grand old time.
Yeah, it seems like the fans have a real genuine, well, thirst and appreciation for motorcycle racing, and they haven't gotten dragged into the, you know, the uglier side of the tribalism. And it's super nice to see that. I know that in the past I've been a little critical of, well, whether it's MotoGP or superbike racing or whatever it might be, ending up kind of being used as oligarch play toys, you know, ending up in places where there really isn't a history of racing, where you really wonder what it is that they're doing there. This is definitely not that. The place was just jam-packed of people, super into bike racing, having a great time. And like you said, Marquez fans and Valentino Rossi fans having a good time sitting next to each other. Really, really like to see that.
And the great thing, too, is certainly for Moto3, there was some good wild cards on the grid as well for the fans to cheer for.
Yeah, definitely. It looks like the guys from the Asia Talent Cup, they've probably obviously ridden there a few times already, so they know the circuit. And they seem to hold their own, you know, pretty well. They weren't running way up front. They weren't winning the race. but they were certainly doing pretty well.
Yeah. So we'll have a run through the Moto3, the Moto2, and then ultimately the MotoGP. I think, you know, when you come, you're looking at Moto3, you're really looking at the sort of the top two, maybe three. We've got Jorge Martin currently number one in the standings, followed by Marco Bezzecchi. Fabio Giantonio's there in third, but, you know, just that sort of another 28 points behind second place. I guess Bastianini as well in fourth. He's that little bit further behind. So all three, four of those guys looking to still have a strong event. And it was interesting that it was Jorge Martin who actually had some issues this weekend after, and I think this is the first that I've ever heard this. Yes, he had the crash back in Brno, but he had problems with his hand, not from a crash, but from a massage that went wrong.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that's what it was. I mean, I came into it just seeing that he had some hand damage.
No, from what I understand, I think that's just part of the regular massage that he has as part of the physio on his left hand from that original crash in Brno. And somehow the masses pinched a nerve or something, leaving him with pretty much sort of no strength in that left hand to operate the clutch. So this was a real concern for him, because this was, you know, obviously he's leading the championship, and Bezzecchi must have thought, well, this is a great opportunity for me to maybe kind of pull back some points. I mean, especially when you go back and you look through qualifying, I think, you know, Jorge Martin ended up qualifying 13th on the grid with Bezzecchi taking top spot.
Yeah, it really looked like Bezzecchi was right there to bring it all together. And I liked how during the race they kept on showing in one corner of the screen sort of the virtual championship standings. And since there was a lot of shuffling around, you know, Martin was doing very well during the race. He kept creeping forward, so it kept shrinking that gap. And then depending where, you know, the front couple of riders swapping spots, or how Martin was doing back in, you know, 5th, 6th, 7th place, it was jumping all over the place, and it was great. It was looking really close, like we were going to come out of here with almost a dead heat for the championship.
Yeah, you're right. You know, Martin was like pretty far down, but he just seemed to be able to keep making up places little bit by little bit. They had this, they'd improvised some elastic or something onto his glove. I was trying to remember how it worked. I think it sort of worked over the top of the glove, essentially. But this would allow him, hopefully, to give him enough strength or enough mobility in his left hand to work the clutch. And, you know, he was able to, even that far down, keep out of trouble, which was pretty impressive given how much of a bun fight it was for a majority of the race, and keep working his way forwards and just keep picking up places.
Yeah, keeping out of trouble. But as I was watching him, I was wincing repeatedly because he was putting some pretty hard moves on people to get through.
Yeah, that's true. But it was hard to keep track of everything because, I mean, you know, we had, you know, Bezzecchi, I think, was able to get away a little bit at the front. So he was definitely doing everything he could to maximize his opportunity to take some points there. But yeah, I mean, there was some really, really aggressive passing. And I think part of that is down to the track layout. You know, when you have these long straights, everybody just sort of just goes like 15 abreast into these heartbreaking corners.
Yeah, they were definitely, it was a huge freight train. I mean, I think the lead group was well past the top 10. There was like 12 people in it. Then there was a little bit of a breakaway, but big group of guys and lots of super tight racing. And like you said, it was it looked like it was going to even up the championship right up until the end.
Yeah, that's right. And then, you know, even sort of getting into the last couple of laps, you know, you've got Bezzecchi and Giantonio up front and everything. And then, I mean, you know, Bezzecchi's in the lead, and then it's all sort of swapping places in the last corner. I remember we had Bezzecchi in third, Bastianini in fourth, and it's all looking good until I think it was Bastianini up the inside of Bezzecchi, and, you know, he loses it on the brakes. I think he just had to pull himself up a little bit harder on the brakes. He got up the inside of Bezzecchi, and he looked pretty clean, but unfortunately he came a bit too close to his teammate up there, Della Porta, and you just see he had to just yank on the brakes a little bit harder. The front collapses, and then that just wipes out Bezzecchi as well. I couldn't believe it, because I'm thinking, like, I'm just trying to think, how many times has Bezzecchi gone down now, like, on the last lap?
Well, and on his own, but this time, poor guy paid the price for somebody else.
I mean, that, yeah, that was like a hard bit of for him to swallow. But, you know, Martini had managed to work his way up into fourth. Dennis Foggia in third. I can't remember where he started on the grid. I think he was way, way down. So to get up into fourth, that was amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was the story of the race. He started in 25th.
25th.
And, yeah, yeah. And they mentioned him a couple times early in the race. I think not so much because of his position, because he was so far down there, but he was setting really good times, obviously, if he was moving through the field. And then just a little bit at a time, you know, all of a sudden he was up there, all of a sudden he was with the lead group, and then he worked his way through it. I think he even led the race for a little bit, which was, you know, pretty incredible for somebody who started 25th.
Yeah, no, that's pretty, that was pretty impressive. So like I say, it was Fabio Giantonio who took the win from Della Porta, Dennis Foggia in third with Jorge Martin in fourth. So that really helps him and his championships as he takes, I think, what was going to be now a 26-point lead into Japan. Bezzecchi's still there in second, but like I say, that gap's just growing now. I think we could look back and see that that really was you know, the race that decided the championship.
Yeah, yeah. It was great seeing Martin, even though he was in fourth place and obviously with his hand hurting, he was feeling good enough to do a massive wheelie the length of the straight.
I'm just looking down. Other good results as well was the Thai wildcard Chantra as well. He had a really good finish in ninth. Kornfeldt as well, up in 10th, considering, you know, where he started too.
Yeah, yeah. Kornfeldt would have even done better, but he got caught up in that last lap crash. He had to take evasive action. He went way, way wide, but, you know, came back 10th. I think he was, you know, he was on for like a third or fourth position.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, he was up to fourth at one point there, wasn't he?
Yeah. So, yeah, bad luck for him. Good race, but bad luck.
Yeah. So that kind of set, that really sort of set the standard for the rest of the racing, you know, when we got into Moto 2 as well. Looking at Moto 2, you know, I think really it was coming down to Bagnaia, who's currently leading the standings, 234 points. Miguel Oliveira, the KTM rider, second, 215th. His teammate, Brad Binder, in third, 144. So clearly, I mean, you know, the championship for Moto 2 is between those top two riders, Bagnaia and Oliveira. You know, looking down into qualifying, it was Oliveira who was able to just get that slightly better qualifying position in fifth, Bagnaia in sixth. It was Baldessari who took the top spot in first with Alec Marquez in second, and the other Sky Racing Team VR46 rider, Luca Marini, in third.
Yeah, and it was interesting the way the race started off. I mean, in the past, we've seen in general, you know, in general terms, the Calix riders get out front, do really well in the beginning of the race, have the bike sort of come to the KTM riders and have them finish really strongly. But here it seems like those roles were reversed, and it made me wonder, is it, you know, is it down to really nobody having, obviously nobody's got any past data for a circuit like this? Were they going into the race with a setup that was, you know, quite different from previous races and left them reversing those roles? Really interesting to see it play out that way.
Yeah, it was. And it was really surprising from my standpoint, too, just to see how aggressive the KTMs were right from the get-go.
Super aggressive, yeah.
And from that, too, is watching Bagnaia. You know, Bagnaia, when you get to the front, normally you expect him, as he gets into the lead, he just becomes that sort of metronomic person of consistency. And I don't know if the heat was playing trouble either with the tires or what, but there was a number of times, I don't know if it was from the pressure from the KTMs, but you would see him running wide and getting offline. And, you know, there were some fairly aggressive moves and a little bit of bumping and nudging, both from Oliveira and Binder as well.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. I think all the riders were doing that. I don't know if it's the nature of the circuit, you know, with rushing into these fairly tight corners, you know, second gear corners, coming off of long straights, you know, so they're running in there pretty hard. But lots of people going very wide, having other people, you know, check it and come in underneath them. So lots of chopping and changing, lots of changing of the order in that sense. And, you know, that was really good. That kept the racing tight.
Yeah, so we had the top three at the front really, really battling for position. It was only really after sort of halfway through the race that Bagnaia was able to sort of get out front, find some consistency, and then start to put like a sort of a second and a half gap. Meanwhile, we had Marquez, unfortunately, crashing out, I think, from fourth or fifth as he was battling with Marini. They had a bit of a fight, and then I think they got their head down, were trying to chase down the top three, but as Marquez was pushing, I think he lost it at turn five. And turn five did claim quite a number of people through Moto3 and Moto2 as well. And you could see, I think, you know, as he went to his bike and he couldn't lift it, he was pretty upset, I think, by that crash. And unfortunately, that really just tops off what is fairly poor form for him for that second half of the season.
Yeah, yeah, it's really unfortunate because it looked like, you know, maybe he was going to be able to turn things around. Well, finish a race to start with and then maybe even do well at it. But it just didn't work. And I think that it was exactly what you said. You know, Marini got in front, took off, and he was giving chase and just got into that turn five a little too tight. The front end went away from him, and that was it. You know, he almost looked like he was crying in the gravel. He was so upset.
Yeah. And then it was cool because toward the end of the race there, although we had Bagnaia out in the lead, Oliveira and Binder were joined by Marini and Quartararo as well. He was kind of looking like he might be able to get into the mix, but it really came down to those top four. There were some great scraps for position between Oliveira, Marini in that last lap. And a lot of it all came down to, as usual, turn 12, the last corner.
Yeah, you know, and Marini really, really impressed me. I mean, he's been coming on the last couple of races. He's done pretty well already, but it seems like something has changed. And maybe it's just that confidence thing. You know, once you know you can do it, then you go out there and repeat it. But all of a sudden, he's come from, you know, kind of a fifth, sixth, seventh place rider to somebody who can, you know, finish on podiums and fight up front with the top riders. Really, really good to see.
Yeah, I agree. It was a pretty mature ride, you know, not getting too panicked as the top guys pulled away in the early part of the race, keeping his head down, keeping it consistent and keeping it upright as well so he could be there to fight in the end. So it was Francisco Bagnaia who took the win. Luca Marini about second and a half behind him, just ahead of Miguel Oliveira on the KTM with his teammate Brad Binder there in fourth. Fabio Quartararo, you know, maybe starting to demonstrate why he's, you know, he's got that MotoGP ride for next year. He was about 6 seconds back. And then there were some other good rides as well. Just looking down at Eco Lecuono for the Swiss Innovative Investors team. I mean, he brought home that bike in seventh. Unfortunately, his teammate Sam Lowes crashed on the last lap. I think he was just pushing just that little bit too hard on the last lap. Other good results too from Remy Gardner in 12th and Joe Roberts, I saw there in 13th.
Yeah, yeah. I think I heard somebody mention, is that the first points for Joe Roberts this year?
Could well be. I think, yeah, just getting it in the points there. That was pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah. And another first point for Nicky Tulli, the guy who came from World Supersport and Superstock before that. So good runs for both of those guys.
Yeah. And we also had Edgar Pons, who was sitting in, taking the spot of Danny Kent in 19th. You know, I'm not convinced if he's the man to replace Danny, but we'll see. We'll see how he gets on.
Well, and if he's not, there are plenty of guys out there that'll tear your arm off for a seat. So I'm sure that'll work itself out.
Good point. So the final standings after that, Bagnaia really extending his lead, 259 points. Oliveira there in 231. Binder back in 157. So I think, you know, as we go into these last, five races now, it's all between Bagnaia and Oliveira.
Yeah, and it seems that that lately Pecco is on a real run. So I think the small points gap and a little bit the form that he's got recently, you know, the momentum, as people like to say, really seems to be favoring him. I hope it stays tight until the end. I'd love to see Miguel Oliveira do well and, you know, bring it all the way to the end of the season. But I think I'd have to put my money on Pecco right now.
Yeah, agreed. And that was some pretty exciting racing as well. So we can have a few more Moto2 races like that.
Yes, please.
I wouldn't be unhappy.
Yep.
So let's have a look at the big boys, the MotoGP. it was interesting going through like Friday. There was a few different things. You know, Jorge had come into MotoGP this weekend planning to ride, even though he was still nursing his broken foot and his fixed dislocated toe. Unfortunately, it wasn't to be. He had a rather nasty crash in free practice too. It looked like the rear of the bike just locked up completely, spat him off there, and he came down pretty heavily. Didn't break any other bones, but had some pretty nasty bumps and bruises when we saw him in the debrief after that.
Pretty bad luck to already be so beat up from Aragon and to come in and have something like that happen. Hoping that he heals well, that he can get back in there. I mean, he certainly doesn't have much to do for the championship, but now that he's got the Ducati figured out, I'd love to see him make it a little more interesting than just two riders for the rest of the year.
And he was a little bit unlucky in rewatching that crash as the bike locked up the back as he was braking into the corner. Unfortunately, you know, there's that period of braking where you're fairly vertical, fairly straight up. And if it had gone there, I think he would have been okay. But unfortunately, it locked as he tipped the bike in. So the bike was at an angle.
Yep.
The back lock slid and then caught and spat him off. And it was pretty nasty. It was surprising for me. Well, maybe it's not so surprising, but of course, I wanted to know, okay, so what happened? What broke? You know, what was the issue? And as much as we ever got was just the fact that it was, quote, a technical problem. And that's as much as I've heard or read. I don't know if you've heard anything more enlightening.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I and I forget where I read it, was somebody from the team, and it was one of the bosses of the Ducati team, admitting and saying that there was a technical fault, but not saying what it was. So you kind of get the impression that he was coming out and saying that for a couple reasons. You know, one, to get in front of it and accept it and sort of kill any rumors before they get started. And two, really to take the blame off of Jorge, you know, just to come out and say, yeah, it doesn't look like it was his fault. He didn't do anything. Something went wrong on the bike.
Is it just me, though? I don't know why. I want to hear, like, oh, yeah, the gearbox locked or the engine seized. I mean, it probably doesn't make any difference, but just the sense of just, I can't help it. I want to know. But, yeah, what was the problem, though?
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm sure it was an electronics problem. You know, some of the electrons in the transmission got jammed up against each other and the transmission couldn't turn anymore or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I always feel I want to know, because often, you know, the riders, if they make a mistake or they make, you know, there's an error, it's sort of full on public display. And I just, it sometimes just feels disingenuous that the teams can be, you know, a little less candid and, you know, just disguise it as either a quote electrical problem or a quote technical problem.
Yeah. But that's the way they are. Did you happen to see the quote from Lorenzo's dad about the aftermath of the crash?
No, tell me.
He said something in some interview to somebody in a Spanish press, saying that, well, I'll bet that Marquez's camp are all very happy and laughing about it. And I just thought, man, like father, like son.
Yeah, well, maybe that's where he gets it from. That feels a bit unnecessary. And
it just seemed like, you know, things have the possibility of quieting down a little bit, so let's throw some gasoline on it. Yeah, too bad.
One thing that was a bit of a surprise before we got into qualifying was the Yamahas. I mean, they ended up free practice one on top, and they were still going good in free practice two.
Yeah, and again, I don't think anybody expected it. Anybody looking at the track, you know, and again, I fell into that same trap, forgetting about the second half of the circuit, thought, oh no, this is a Ducati circuit, or at best a Honda circuit. And after the way the Yamahas struggled at Aragon, thought, oh my God, you know, they're going to have a really tough time here. It makes me wonder if what this is really all down to is going to a place where nobody has any data, sort of levels the field, and everybody just throws, you know, a decent base setting at it and goes and rides.
Yeah, there could be something in that. It was interesting. There was a few different comments. I mean, Cal Crutchlow was quoted as saying that somehow they found a second a lap. If you seemingly spoke to either Rossi or Vinales, they were just shrugging their shoulders, saying, like, I don't know, we didn't really change much at anything since the last race, so we don't really know where the performances come. I saw something else from Vinales saying, well, that's, you know, because they finally listened to me, have done what I asked, and have changed the balance of the bike with some sort of suggestion. They'd move the weight backwards to try and cure the spinning, to try and give them more rear traction. And then other people just saying like, well, you know, it sounds like it could just be the heat. You know, the extra warmth is allowing the tires to hook up and grip better. And now the Yamahas are able to take advantage of the inherent performance they have as been just being like a good bike.
Yeah, you know, it could be all of those things, or, you know, any of them or any combination of all of them. But I think something Rossi said, and I think it was after the race, was really telling. He was very congratulatory toward Yamaha, saying that they've changed the way that they're working, that there are some new members of the project. And it really made me wonder if after the very public apology a couple races ago, if you know, if something hasn't been radically changed back in Japan to, well, like Valentino says, change the way they're working, or maybe just take some new ideas on board.
Well, and maybe one of the ingredients is the Michel Garda, the ex Ducati electronics engineer that Yamaha has hired. I think initially when they hired him, he was on sort of a gardening leave. So there was a period of time where he has to sort of sit on his hands and can only sort of maybe given yes and no answers to certain questions. But maybe, you know, he's able now to start to contribute more and help them with some of their electronic strategies, which is starting to pay dividends as well.
Yeah, yeah, that would definitely make sense. I mean, since the Common Electronics started as Ducati Electronics, that's the people you want.
So as we went into qualifying, apart from the improved performance of the Yamaha, one of the other surprises when you look in qualifying one is one of the participants, Mr. Marc Márquez, found himself in qualifying one. I had to think back to try and think, you know, when the last time he actually had to go through qualifying one. But it sounds like he'd had some issues with his bike number one. And then he, the last of free practice three, ran into the pits, got his second bike, which was on the hard tires, a little bit cold, goes down, has a crash in the dying seconds of free practice three, and therefore wasn't really able to improve his time, therefore ended up having to go through qualifying one.
Well, that's a real shame. The old throw the bike down the road, run back to the pits, go out and set pole just didn't quite work for him this time.
Yeah, but unsurprisingly, you know, so he's in qualifying one right from the get-go. He's straight onto the pace and, you know, blitzing everybody by a good half a second on the mediums. There were some people wondering if we'll see him even run the softs in qualifying one, or if he felt confident enough that he could do everything he needed to do on the mediums. As it was, he did do his last run on the softs, so he topped out qualifying one with a 130.03. It was Alex Rinsen's second, 0.9 seconds behind. That was the best the Suzuki rider could do to finish second in qualifying one. Morbidelli in third, and then I think, you know, really the rest of qualifying one was all the usual names.
Yeah, it was interesting to see him, you know, in that Q1 session, running at the same time on the same tires, you know, same conditions as everyone else. It was the perfect indication of, you know, how far ahead is he actually, and the answer was a full second, which is amazing.
Yeah, we had Bradley Smith, the KTM rider, in fifth. His teammate was down in ninth, still running injured and therefore not up to full strength. The KTMs, I think, were running a different aero package. They'd moved from these funny side pods to these sort of moustache wings, like a lot of the other teams are riding. I guess this is still part of their, you know, each race for them is also part test session as well. Not necessarily sure if I heard a lot of information to hear that it made a huge amount of difference for them.
Yeah, but I get the impression that playing with the downforce from the wings and different kinds of wings and all of that is kind of one of those last half a percent things. It seems like KTM has more and important things that they need to test to get themselves up there.
Yeah, I kind of been disappointed a little bit with KTM. I really hoped that they would be more consistently further up the field. But, you know, as you talk to the riders, I mean, obviously Poles, sort of the lead test rider in some respects and has had injuries. But talking to Bradley as well, you just realize how hard it is for them as a rider and for them as a team, because they almost bring so many updates, so many little changes that it's really a constant moving target. And it's really, really hard to sit and just have a consistent platform that they can figure out how to make changes and where to get the improvements from.
Yep, I agree. I was hoping to see the same sort of trajectory from them from last year. You know, everybody was so amazed how they did last year. It hasn't quite worked this year. But what I keep trying to remind myself is what Matt said on the show. Matt Oxley said on the show a while ago. He said, "Yeah, you know, they might have a bit of a lull right now. You know, they're having that tough second album effect. But you know, KTM and Red Bull don't lose. They'll put the resources in place." They'll keep doing the work. They won't be discouraged by having a bit of a lull, and long term, they'll probably be right up there. So we just have to keep waiting and watching.
Yeah, I think hopefully that'll be into next year. My hope is toward the end of this year, you know, they can go back, they can crunch all the data, they can really do some detailed analysis, some winter testing, and then hopefully, you know, hit the ground in 2019 with a competitive package.
You were saying about testing, and that there might be something in that as well. I mean, Paul's not healthy right now, not being able to help there, and Kallio is out of commission as well. So the combination of those things could be hurting them just as much as any, you know, lack of technical advancement.
Yeah, exactly. Good point. So for qualifying two, it was Marc Marquez pretty quickly going top with a 130.5. We had Petrucci and Vinales chase them in second and third. Marquez was really, really pushing for that pole position. I mean, we had heard that for the sections of this track did make it pretty hard to pass. I think, like I say, sectors 3 and 4, pretty flowing, but it only meant there was a single line. So there was a lot to play for, that pole position was something important. And we definitely saw that with Marquez really, really pushing qualifying, you know, losing the front almost at least once or twice during that qualifying two session.
Yeah, yeah. And being up front was also super important, as we saw later, for Valentino Rossi, doing a whole lot better than he's done, done in recent memory. He was out in front for, I forget how many laps it was. It must have been 3, 4, maybe up to 5 laps. And it seemed like the riders were, you know, sometimes bunching up behind him, especially in the first half of the circuit. But he really owned that last half. They were as close as they were getting to him, and, you know, sniffing for a way past, they didn't seem to have any way past in the second half.
It was pretty amazing, just a reminder sometimes of how qualifying can go. I mean, I think we only had like 5 minutes or so remaining, and Miller was sat currently third. And then after the last flurry of laps, where at one point we had Rossi potentially on pole, it was Marquez who was able to pip him to pole by literally 0.01 of a second. Miller ended up down in 10th. So you just that last batch just shows how competitive it was. And pretty much everybody in those top 12 positions were in the 1 minute 30s. I mean, it was just under a second covering those top 12 positions.
All of Q2 in 130s. And like you were saying, there was a half a second in it between pole and 10th place Jack Miller. So amazingly, amazingly close these days.
So as we said, Marquez was on pole. Rossi was next to him second. Dovizioso was able to get up there on the front row. Vinales, Crutchlow, and Iannone. And then Pedrosa, I don't know, you know, maybe showing some potential, I think, for the race. You know, it was a place with the heat. We were hoping that he might go a little bit better, but I think he was hindered because he realized through his free practice race simulations that he was going to have to run the hard. He didn't have much choice. It turned out, I think, only one rider ended up starting the race on the soft tire. I think everybody else went for the hard rears. And unfortunately, that really put Danny on the back foot as it came to qualifying and into the race as well.
Yeah, yeah. And just behind Danny was Johann Zarco. And what I thought was really interesting there was, you know, here out of nowhere, three Yamahas in the top eight, which isn't something that we've seen in quite a while. And Zarco's not going to be the same story as the factory Yamahas. You know, maybe the factory Yamahas found something, maybe they've done something with their organization, maybe they've got this new electronics guy, whatever it might be. But you wouldn't think that a lot of that would affect Johann Zarco on, you know, a year-old Yamaha on a completely different team that doesn't get all that stuff handed down. So again, it really makes it look like the second half of the circuit being a little more flowing was quite an equalizer.
Yeah, you're totally right about Zarco. I spoke to him briefly in Misano, and one of the comments I remember that really stuck in my head is him saying that, the question was essentially, are you still getting parts? Are you getting any help? Is there any upgrades in the pipeline for the remainder of the season? And Zarco just shook his head and sort of looked down a little bit at the floor. He said, no. He says, Yamaha, how do you say they've turned the page? I think obviously, with him and Monster Tech 3 off to KTM, not much help coming there. So everything he did that on his own.
Yep.
So we get into the race, and I was interesting to sort of like see how this was going to go. Like I say, going in, everyone had been talking about that this was going to be a Ducati track, and certainly with those long straights, you felt Ducati was basically going to get out in front, and maybe Dovizioso was going to romp ahead, but it was Marquez into the lead, and he was being pushed pretty early on by a rather excited Valentino Rossi.
Rossi was on it like we haven't seen in quite a while. I was hoping it wasn't just going to be a mirage, that it wasn't, going to end up, well, like we've seen in the past, a few good laps, burn up the tires, end up falling back in the pack. But it looked like the closest thing we've seen to the real thing in a long time.
But I think equally too, it struck me that when I look over the entirety of the race, it felt like the race was almost in thirds. There was like this sort of first third where it was the sense of seeing if any of the front runners were going to try and make a break. And I got a sense a few of them did try to push for some pretty fast laps to see if they could break, to see if they could get away. And very quickly, once they realized that, Marquez, Dovizioso and sort of Rossi were all there. And, you look at Crutchlow, I think he was in fourth for majority of that race, not too far behind. There was this sense that no one really quite had enough to make a break, to go away. So then like the middle third of the race, middle half maybe, almost seemed to calm down, where it looked to my mind that Marquez and Dovizioso were trying to just see, what's the least that I need to do to stay out front here. They were definitely a little bit quicker, I think, than the following guys. There was Marquez, Dovizioso and Rossi. They just had that little bit more pace than, say, Crutchlow and Vignale, especially in the early part. But Marquez seemed to give up the lead and just seemed to sit there behind Dovizioso, just sort of keeping tabs on him. And now you got the sense we'd entered into a portion of a bit of a chess match, a bit more of a strategic. So you knew, or my sense was like, okay, it's like at some point someone is going to start pulling the pin with, I don't know, six laps to go or something. And that's when the real race was going to start.
It reminded me a lot of bicycle racing, whether it's, climbing a mountain and seeing who decides to, like you said, pull the pin and go and see if he can break the pack, or even pursuit racing, where that's exactly what they do. They're all sort of riding around at a standstill and just waiting to see if you can get the jump on somebody. And that's really what it felt like for the middle part of the race, And I totally agree with what you said, that it looked like first Marquez and then Rossi, had a go, thought, if I can get away, I'll try to do that. That didn't seem to be working, or at least I think it probably sunk into them. The tires won't take it for the entire, for the length of the race, and maybe their body won't take it. If they're dealing with some pretty incredible heat, it's a situation where, full race distance, you're just not going to be able to go at 100%, physically or because of the machinery. And that really, really changed the character of the race. I know I was complaining to you a little bit after it, saying that I felt a little bit cheated, like we weren't getting full races anymore, like we're getting half chess matches, half races. Made me wonder if maybe we wouldn't be better served by having two short races, World Superbike style. But regardless, it did all sort of sort itself out. That middle strategic pursuit racing component sort of played itself out, and then once they decided to go, they really decided to go, and it was pretty, pretty damn good till the end.
Yeah, it was. It's funny you mentioned about the cycle racing. I think I caught an interview with Valentino Rossi after the press conference, and he made exactly that same comment that it is sort of getting strategic like that. Unfortunately, one of the people we did lose, and really the only faller, was Pedrosa, who went down, I think around about lap 18 or so. He went down at turn 5. He, I think, had just got past Vinales and was trying to close down Crutchlow in fourth. And I think at that point when he went down, he was pretty much the fastest was on track. So he definitely had found some pace. I think he was hoping to use that, hoping to be able to get there in contention. And I know he was running the hard, but there was that hope too that he'd still have a lot of grip left towards the end. Unfortunately, with that fall, he didn't get to take part in the race. So really, it came down to, I think, you know, Vinales somehow had been able to just maybe manage his rear tire just that little bit better. He was able to pass Rossi to get himself up into third. So now we really had a three-way battle, and it really did feel like a three-way battle. I mean, really, it was Dovi who was taking the lead. Marquez looking very scrappy behind him. I mean, if you compare the two riding styles, I think someone else went on to make the comparison between, you know, Schwantz and Rainey. Back in those days, but Dovi really looked clean, clinical, precise. He was really concentrating, it seemed, on just hitting his marks for those last few laps. Marquez was the scrapper terrier, trying a few different places. I think it was fairly clear with four laps to go or something like that. I think, you know, Marquez really tried his first pass, but couldn't quite manage it, ran wide. Dovi was able to just look very calm and mature, sweep back into the lead. Vinales was there in third spot, kind of a watching brief. I don't think he really was in a position to put any passes on Mark, but definitely in a position to inherit any accidents that happened.
Going back to Marquez, you're right. He was in full terrier mode, and I was really wondering if he was going to finish, because especially going into the last corner, several times, the way he was braking and tipping, you know, into the corner with the back tire still in the air, I thought, wow, you know, that's a pretty good balancing act, and that's going to work several times, but that might not work every time. But, you know, he was able to keep it together right up until the end when him and Dovi swapped roles. But then with Vinales, I got the impression that he had saved his tire. You know, he'd been riding back there in fourth, fifth, and sixth, keeping the leaders in sight. And I don't know, maybe he didn't think that there was any more that he could do, or maybe he was confident enough that he could get up there if he saved his tire. Regardless, I think that's the way it worked out. I think at the very end, he had a little more left than Rossi was able to get past him. It was too bad. I was thinking that, you know, it would have been nice for Valentino to get the payback of the early work that he did by at least getting up on the podium. But regardless, it seemed like both he and Maverick were felt rewarded by getting that third and fourth place.
Yeah, I think it seemed to my mind the last lap, like Dovi and Mark really just sort of threw everything they had.
Yeah, they had another gear.
Yeah, so they just, you know, they, I think by the end of that, they just been able to pull out like a half a second or so, I think, on Vinales. I mean, Mark had been looking every which way, trying to find a way around Dovi, and I think he figured out ultimately how to do it. You know, it was pretty exciting. You know, you think he's got past, you think he's done it, but then, you know, Dovi comes back at him at the final turn to start the final lap. So we really had, you know, a really good final lap with Dovi leading. Very, very defensive, I think, into turn three. You know, Mark was able to pass him back into turn five, which was pretty impressive. Dovi was almost able to come back underneath him, but Mark was able to turn it just tight enough to come back online and then hold it from then. It was pretty comical in a way to see that reverse of fortune as it was left to Dovi to do the sort of the big lunge at the last corner to go up the inside to run wide. Marquez, in that same sense, you know, you got the sense he knew it was coming. Either I don't know if he himself outbraked himself, but he kind of went a little wide, and that allowed Dovi the space to just go way wide so Mark could get it cut back, take the drive and take the win. I don't know if you noticed on the replay, you know, into that same last corner as well, it looked to my mind that Rossi tried a pretty big lunge at that into the last corner at Vinales as well, because if you check the replay, Rossi only just missed clipping the back of Vinales. I don't know if you saw that.
I did see that, yeah, and it was almost identical. Well, it was a whole lot closer, you know, Rossi's front to Vinales' rear than Dovizioso and Marquez were. But yeah, I think it came pretty close to being a bit of a disaster, and Rossi went in very, very hot. I think even hotter than Dovizioso. He was super, super wide before he finally got it stopped, checked, and, you know, turned up the track. So yeah, almost a bit of a disaster, but luckily there wasn't anybody too close behind him, and he was able to gather it up.
Yeah, so he was able to bring it back in fourth, but like you say, that could have been really, really embarrassing to have the I don't know if he's the number one rider. I can never tell with Vinales and Rossi who's the number one. I think they both think they're number one. But yeah, that would have been awful with such a great result on the cards if they'd taken themselves out like that.
Certainly. I mean, if they had knocked themselves down in 15th and 16th place, it would have been one thing. But on for a third and fourth, yeah, that would have been a bit of a problem.
So Mark takes the win. Dovizioso came second with Vinales running out the podium in third. Rossi still... You'd have to think, going in to this race, if you told either Vinales or Rossi that there's a third and a fourth in the offing after their performance at Aragon, I think they would have been absolutely over the moon. You know, I think what stops them being absolutely over the moon is them not understanding what has this come from. So we'll have to see, I think, as we go into Japan, if Yamaha really have had an uptick in performance and if they can start to figure out what it is that's helping them sort it out. And it was the other satellite Yamaha, Zarco, in fifth. And so that was pretty impressive. Rins in six. Crutchlow unfortunately faded towards the end. I'm assuming that was either his front, which tends to go off running in the pack, or maybe his rear just ran out of grip as well in seventh. And Bautista, not a bad eighth.
No, not bad at all. And then some of the other riders that we're used to see do, you know, pretty well, but, you know, certainly not podium style. Petrucci in ninth, Miller in tenth, Iannone right behind him. But what I thought was best was... there were 10 seconds covered nine places, and it was only 11 seconds back to 10th place. So pretty, you know, pretty tight racing. Not everybody was, you know, right up there in the same corner at the same time. Pretty evenly matched and pretty tight racing these days.
Yeah, unfortunately, we miss out a little bit when there's a tight race at the front. That's tend to be where the TV coverage focuses, and you tend to miss some of the interesting battles going on, you know, down in the sort of the mid pack. One of the notes, you know, just to say that Jordi Torres, second ever MotoGP, finished 19th. Maybe only 2 seconds behind his teammate on arguably a better bike, but that meant he beat Thomas Luthi, he beat Pol Espargaro and Nakagami as well. I think Nakagami crashed, actually, though he must have remounted. So, I mean, I guess it was no surprise. Mark, you know, just really does now cement his leadership. I think it's mathematically possible for him to wrap up the championship at Japan. Is that correct?
That's what I heard, but I'll admit I don't know the combinations. I don't know what everybody else needs to do or what he needs to do. But I think the practical reality of it is that he just needs to keep doing what he's doing and he'll be fine.
Did it even ever cross your mind when you were watching the sort of fight between Mark and Dovi? Did you ever sort of think like, but Mark, you've got this huge lead in the championship. Why even bother? Just sit there, take a nice safe second, you know, just take the points. Like, what's the big deal? And then recognize and realize like, oh yeah, that's right. That's why I'm not a motorcycle racer.
Yeah, I'll admit that I never thought that. And it's because I think Mark's just got us all so conditioned that that's what he does.
Yeah, if there's a sniff, if there's a chance. And actually, maybe, you know, with that extra pad in the championship, you know, maybe that's what emboldens him to sort of roll the dice and take the chances. Because at the end of the day, it wouldn't have been the end of the world if he had gone down.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the way he looks at it. You know, many riders would say, I'm, you know, what is he, 80 points ahead of Dovizioso and almost 100 points ahead of Rossi. Most riders would think, well, that's it. I can take it easy. You know, if this was 40 years ago, Agostini would have already been on a boat in the Mediterranean somewhere. He wouldn't even go to the last races.
Exactly.
Mark's a different character. I think he sees that as license to just hang it all out. And I think that's fantastic.
You sometimes feel with him and maybe some of the other riders and racers as well, like, you know, the championship is sort of incidental. It's just this opportunity to every 2 weeks, just go do a race and win. And that, I think, is what drives them because that, you know, like I say, I couldn't help it. I was sat there just thinking like, you know, I'm that more logical, pragmatic, you know, sort of evaluate, you know, less risk and all the rest of it, which is, like I say, why I am not Marc Márquez.
Definitely. It's Mark is such a great combination. I mean, you know, it's all been said already, the smiling assassin and the Joker and all of these things that people call him. But it's also true. I see in him every bit the, you know, the bloody-headed determination, the wanting to just crush everybody else. It's the same as McDoohan. He just happens to smile while he's doing it. And I think that's great.
Yeah, you're right. He does always have a smile on his face. And I think there is genuine enthusiasm and excitement. I think he genuinely enjoys it. I never really got the sense that it's something he puts on for the cameras. Nothing seems to make him happier than having a really good battle and coming out on top.
Yeah, exactly. It's all working for him, and while it keeps going like that, it's a virtuous circle, and he'll just keep being happier and faster.
So I guess the golden t-shirts and the golden helmet and everything will be started to be printed, made, shipped to Motegi for the Japanese round in 2 weeks' time on October the 21st, where we'll see if Marc Marquez can crown his world championship for 2018.
I bet the golden t-shirts and helmets and all of that are already there.
Yeah, I agree. And then this weekend, we've got World Superbike in Argentina for the first time at the Villicum circuit. By and large, I think they've got it all finished. It was funny to hear that some of the gantries and bridges were just going in place so they could get the advertising hoardings up. So there'll probably be some last finishing touches even on the Saturday before the races.
Well, I hope it all comes together on time. I'm Mexican, so I have permission to talk a little shit about my Latin American brothers. And I can imagine that it's all hands on deck and that they're all going crazy the last days to get that ready.
Yeah, it's going to be entertaining to see. I think part of the fun, too, will just be seeing if all the journalists, teams, and equipment actually make it out there. Because looking on the map, it's a fairly remote location.
Yeah. Again, not the same as the other Argentinian track, but as much in the middle of nowhere as the other one. So yeah, that will be interesting. I'm sure people will have all kinds of interesting trains, planes, and automobile stories.
And a little closer to home, we'll also have the final round of the British Superbike Championship at Brands Hatch. It's a triple header this weekend. So myself and Dave will be covering that, probably with the World Superbikes as well mixed in, at the beginning of next week. So we can catch up with that and find out if Liam Haslam can indeed capture his first British Superbike Championship.
Well, that sounds great. Sounds like a plenty of racing to keep us busy. They don't step on each other because of the time zones. So yeah, looking forward to that. So are you doing any biking of your own this weekend?
You know what? We've still got a pretty nice Indian summer. We've still got 22, 23 degree days once you get past a little bit of a chilly start to the morning. So yeah, I've still got the moped out running around, but no track days until a couple of days in Jerez in November.
I'm trying to do some super secret testing before we get down to Jerez together. So I'll be at Los Arcos this weekend to give it a go on Saturday and see how it goes.
So this is you testing all your parts upgrade and all your other bits and bobs that you've been investing in, trying to sneak a small advantage.
Exactly. I've got a new front fender, which I figure that's worth at least a couple of seconds. And I'm thinking of making some wings out of cardboard. So we'll see. wait till I see you in Jerez next month to see what I've got.
They'll be modeled on the KTM mustache.
There you go.
Well, thank you very much to Len. Thank you much to our listeners for joining us. That's our show. If you want to get in contact, you can always reach us via email. motopod@motopodcast.com is the address. We look forward to hearing from you. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/motopod. And you can also hit us up on Twitter @moto_pod.
Sounds very good. Looking forward to a great weekend of racing. Have a good one, Andrew.
Cheers, Len. Thanks very much indeed. Take care, everybody.
Bye.